coming off that conversation, the second one for this week on why in the world pastors would permit false teaching into their congregations. It's often said, well, look, come on, we got to take what we get nowadays with pastors. There's a shortage of those guys out there. There really isn't. There really isn't. What there's a shortage of is faithful pastors. You could crank out pastors, put diplomas in their hands and collars on their necks all day long and fill up churches with guys who are at least technically pastors. What we need are those pastors to be faithful. We can have full churches all over the place. If it's not faithful teaching, it is not what Christ intended when he left his church with the gospel that he intended for that church to continue to preach to believers and unbelievers. Well, at Christ Academy 2007, this summer, on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, what they are doing is giving young men of high school age an opportunity to think seriously about becoming a faithful pastor in the church. It's a two-week residential program. They go there, they sleep, they eat, they go to class, they go to chapel, they have an opportunity to interact with other full-fledged seminary students and the faculty there, and they get a chance to mull over the notion of studying for the pastoral ministry in the future. It's called Christ Academy 2007. Find out more about it by going to our website. The logo's right there at our homepage, issuesetc.org. You can also call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Christ Academy is June the 17th through the 30th this summer. The number 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155. I don't know what to think about this story. It comes from the BBC. It's a sad story to begin with, but I imagine it could be sadder still. Some of these countries like Portugal and very highly Roman Catholic countries, Portugal and Italy, are starting to toy with the idea about decriminalizing abortion. Well, here's an old, old alternative to that. It's not the best alternative in the world, but it's certainly better than abortion. This comes from the BBC about Italian women who don't want their babies. Here's what's happening.
At this hospital, six babies born since the beginning of this year have been abandoned at birth. And these are just a fraction of those that are dumped on the streets and never found.
The number of abandoned babies we have is just the tip of the iceberg. The tip is very small, and the base of that iceberg is enormous.
In the Middle Ages, desperate mothers came here. This is a foundling wheel, typical of those built into the walls of churches. Babies were left in the barrel, which was turned by the nuns on the inside. Nowadays, it's just a rusted relic, but in the last month, the wheel has been reinvented.
This is where the idea was born, at a hospital in one of the poorest districts of the city. But you can see this is a far more sophisticated system than the original foundling wheel. The mother opens the window and puts the baby in the crib. There are light sensors all around this room which alert the hospital staff. And the camera is focused purely on the crib. The whole idea of this is that the mother can leave the baby and walk away anonymously.
Since this one was opened, posters like this have appeared around the city. They're aimed at immigrants and have been translated into six languages. A few of the more vulnerable mothers who have come forward are being cared for at this new residential centre. One of them is Elena from Romania, who told me of the dilemma she'd faced.
It's not easy, but from now it's the best.
And when you talk to other mothers here, particularly those mothers who are pregnant and still waiting to have their children, do you sense that some of them are facing very difficult decisions?
Yes. Our moms who, for a moment, have problems, but from 2-3 months...
It may be solvable.
Yes. I see my baby, and after I see him, I told me, for him I can do everything.
Elena has just 6 months to find a job before she'll have to leave this home, and she knows that without a job, she will face more difficult decisions. Within the weeks ahead, the babies abandoned here will be given a name by the local council, and maybe, with foster parents, the start of a new life. It's a life of which their mothers were perhaps dreaming, only to find instead a parent's ultimate despair. Christian Fraser, BBC News,
Rome.
I do not know what to make out of the story. In one sense, it's puzzling because it's almost as though we're in Italy. They are going back to these very, very old practices that simply where the church or other institutions in society acknowledge the fact that there were people who were not going to keep their babies, but to save the baby's life rather than have the baby abandoned or the practice of infanticide, they said, we will take your baby. If you can't care for it, if you won't care for it. Now, there are some laws in the U.S., it varies from state to state, where it is actually legal for a mother to abandon a baby at a hospital. In other words, there's no legal penalty to her if she does this. We all know the story about leaving the baby on the doorstep. Do you think that this is something that should be practiced here in the U.S.? In some of these villages in Italy, there's no penalty and there's kind of no questions asked if a mother who does not want to or can't care for her child simply leaves her child someplace at a designated spot to be cared for by someone else. Do you think pro-lifers should be in favor of something like this? Think about that. Think about it. As an alternative to abortion, picture this. Should your congregation do this? You're driving by a church, and imagine a woman who's thinking about having an abortion driving by a church and seeing a sign that says, thinking about abortion, we will take your baby. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. All of the things that churches and Christians and pro-lifers are doing to try and reduce the need for and give alternatives to abortion, is this a good one? Either laws that would make make it a no crime to leave your baby at a hospital or at a designated spot like a church, provided someone would come along and find this baby right away. Is it a good idea? I want to know what you think. It's Audio Open Lines this Thursday, the 22nd of February. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In Italy, they've found a way to do it. In Italy, they've found a way for mothers who, for whatever reason, cannot care or will not care for their children to leave their children, and the child is immediately taken then, and no questions are asked. We have as much ingenuity as the Italians, don't we? Now, in Italy, they do it because there's a general aversion to abortion. And I think, technically, it's still illegal in Italy. That's not guaranteed, by the way. We've heard a couple stories out of Italy and one out of Portugal, where those two countries, largely Roman Catholic countries, one has actually voted to permit abortion, that's Portugal, in the first 10 weeks of pregnancy, something along those lines. This has got to be better than that. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I really do want your answer to this. Earlier this week, we talked about crisis pregnancy centers and what these, God love them, what they're doing. When a woman comes in off the street, offering them some support, telling them that they don't have to make this rash and hasty decision, offering them financial support. If you read the Time magazine cover story, some of these crisis pregnancy centers will offer a woman $200, $300, $400 on the spot if they need it because they're in financial desperation. Put them in touch with someone who can talk to them, someone give them information about the dangers of abortion. It was all over Time magazine on the cover story. We talked with the author of that story earlier this week. Maybe crisis pregnancy centers could be equipped to do this. Now, it's not a great solution. It's not the best of all possible solutions. Of course, the best of all possible solutions is for the woman to keep her child and all other things to go ahead. But it's better than abortion, isn't it? Let's talk with Barbara, who calls from her car. Hi, Barbara.
Yes, I think it sounds like a good law. Good idea to have it. We've already got it in some hospitals and fire stations and things. I think it should be something that would be a law in the United States, all over.
What do you think about churches doing it? Do you think your church would be willing to promote this on its sign outside that says, thinking of abortion, we will take your baby or we can arrange for you to find someone where you can drop your baby off?
I think there might be a possibility because they are involved in other things for helping the homeless and so on and so forth.
Barbara, thank you very much for the call. Barbara was up first. Who's up next? It's Steve. He's calling from his car. Hi, Steve.
I just got on and was listening to your subject about laws that would protect a mother abandoning an unwanted child.
Right.
You mentioned Italy, but are you aware that we've had a law like that in Missouri for about the last 4 or 5 years?
I am aware of that.
Okay. I just didn't know if that had been mentioned, but there are a few select locations, primarily the hospitals. I think the lady before me mentioned fire departments, police departments. But I do support one of the crisis pregnancy centers here in town financially, and I think I'd be up to expanding that law to other types of locations.
Steve,
I read the Time article also. Hmm. I thought it was somewhat interesting. It was what were your thoughts on it in terms of balance or?
Oh, I thought it was very balanced. We talked with the author, Steve, and thank you for the call. I thought it was very balanced considering the context. There was one point in the Time magazine article where they were talking about what happens to a woman when she walks into a crisis pregnancy center, and then there was kind of a little interpretive spin put on it in the next paragraph that said, you know, coercion may come in many forms, something like that. I don't think it's anyone's intention in the crisis pregnancy centers to practice any kind of coercion. They're trying to save lives is what they're doing. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Who could be opposed to this? Can you think of any arguments that say someone would make against a law like this? We got them in Missouri. Other states have them too. But churches doing this, a church going to the state and saying, we want to be one of the designated places where a woman could legally leave her child if she won't or can't care for this child. Should churches say, we want to be one of those places? Hospitals make sense because, of course, hospitals can take care of sick people and they're very safe places normally. For babies to be.
It's one thing to have a law for it, but it's another thing to actually make people aware of that law or a church to promote it.
Yeah. What woman in the distress of a crisis pregnancy, we'll just call it that for lack of a better term, knows about this law? If this law exists, and it does in Missouri, and it's intended to be the alternative to abortion, that it would seem that pro-lifers would want everyone to know that this law exists. Nate calls from his car. Hi, Nate.
Hey, Todd. Actually, I'm not calling from the car. I'm calling from my house, and I'm trying to keep the phone away from my youngest.
Oh, I know what that's like.
Successfully so far.
All right.
I remember having a discussion with, I believe it was my brother-in-law. It's been a while since we had the discussion, but one of his points was that, you know, if Christians and the pro-life, I believe you said wackos, but it's something to that effect. Anyway, really cared that they would be more willing to accept to adopt these children, you know, as opposed to, you know, if they were basically putting their pocketbooks where their mouths are, as far as being opposed to abortion. And so I think that this topic that churches being willing to accept children anonymously so as to create a more safer, comfortable environment for the woman so she doesn't have to be worried about people knowing who she is. I think it's probably a good thing.
Thank you very much, Nate. Let me, before we go to the other phone calls, I do need to offer one clarification. The criticism, and Nate, I think, articulated it fairly well that he had heard. look, you people are all about wanting to save the fetus, but you don't care about the baby after that. Or why aren't you willing, if you're pro-life, why aren't you willing to adopt 5 or 6 of these babies yourself? Then you'd really be pro-life. Now, I do understand that making these kind of laws more public and putting them on the books could assuage some of that criticism. It never will get rid of that criticism. And we shouldn't be worried about silencing that criticism, because that criticism is bogus. And it's not because pro-lifers are out there adopting a bunch of babies all the time. Some of them do. It's bogus because, well, I think it's Scott Klusendorf. Is that right? Scott Klusendorf, who says, look, when someone tells you this, turn it around and try this. Are you in favor of rape? No. Well, when was the last time you took a rape victim into your home? When was the last time you went down and worked at a rape crisis pregnancy crisis center for women? Why aren't you a doctor specializing in the treatment of women after rape? You're not really against rape. Well, of course, you can be against something you can be against rape and acknowledge it as an objective wrong. Whether or not you give money to rape centers, or whether or not you bring rape victims into your home, is irrelevant as to whether rape is right or wrong. So if the question is whether or not abortion is wrong, which is really the question, if that's the question, that argument doesn't hold any water. The right or wrong of abortion does not depend on the compassion of those who are against it. Up next, here's Landy. She calls from Arizona. Hi, Landy. Landy, welcome. All right, we'll hope that Landy comes back. Let's talk with Cindy then from South County. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Today is the 26th anniversary of our daughter's adoption, and she was found on the road in rural Bangladesh, probably, would have been a victim of infanticide. And she was found by a woman. She was taken to Corpus Christi Catholic Church and then turned over to an orphanage in Dhaka, Bangladesh.
So in effect, her story is actually this story we're talking about.
Exactly.
Here.
It is. And I would be in favor of something like this. There are lots of legal hoops, and you have to make sure that the parents, have to sign off, and because adoptive parents go through lots of risks, when they adopt a child. You don't want to. I mean, this sounds real crass and callous, and I don't mean it to be, but when you start investing time, money in a child's life, you don't want somebody coming in and saying, "Oh, well, now I'm going to take that child back." You don't want to go there. And even though we had an adoption from a foreign country, we had to publish in this country saying, does anybody want to claim this child before parental rights are relinquished? And so it was a very interesting procedure, took a long time, and was worth it. I mean, God has blessed that.
Well, Cindy, thank you very much. And congratulations on the adoption anniversary. How do you celebrate an adoption anniversary? That would be interesting. I'll have to ask some adoptive parents I know. Dave writes from Pennsylvania. He says, in answer to the question, I know the logistics are complicated, but I think that the church specifically should be involved more than the civil authorities. Drop off those babies so we can baptize them and find a way to bring them up in the beliefs of the confessional Lutheran church. Well, ultimately, I think that's what the church was doing in ages past in Europe, and here in the United States, it wasn't a question of whether or not the church should do it. The church never said, should we take these babies in that are being left on the doorstep? They never said, should we? It was a foregone conclusion that they should. They considered it part and parcel if there were people. When abortion, medical, surgical abortion, was not as common as it is today, it was considered part and parcel of what the church does here in this world in service of the neighbor to serve those who are least able to take care of themselves. You know, think about it. This isn't a question of 21st century Italy. This isn't a question of 21st century America. This is a question that the church dealt with from the very beginning. We've talked about this with Dr. Alvin Schmidt. One of the things, I'm sure if he were listening, he would be calling to remind us that from the very beginning, it was a common practice in the Roman world where the Christians first found themselves, that if you didn't want a child, to abandon that child. Or in some cases, it might be selling that child and yourself into slavery. And the church looked at this and said, we have a better idea. And this is where the first orphanages came from. This is where the first places where someone in society, maybe in just a pagan in Roman society, intent upon abandoning their child, which would have meant the child's death, of course, had an alternative. Would it have been best if this child were wanted by their parents? Of course. This is another lie of the pro-choice community. Another lie of the pro-choice community is that the best of all possible worlds is that every baby is wanted. And that unless you can get that, nothing short of that will satisfy them. Ironically, tragically and ironically, that argument is used in favor of abortion. Well, if you abort the unwanted ones, then all the ones left over will be wanted, right? This is actually the argument they use. This is the way they think. We shouldn't buy it for a moment. Yes, maybe the best of all possible worlds would be where every child is a wanted child. But we don't live in that world. We live in a world where children are not wanted by their parents. But I think we offer a better alternative, which is someone does want that child. Maybe not mom. That's sad. But someone does. And there are a lot of those someones out there. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to talk about the Quran. Dr. Adam Francisco is going to be our guest from Concordia University in Bronxville, New York. Sunday night on the program, a can't-miss Issues Etc. This really is one for the... They're not going to put us in history books, are they? No. This is one for you to remember. That's about all the better it's going to get. We're going to be talking with the final two surviving members of a fact-finding committee during the battle for the Bible in the 1970s in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Dr. Paul Zimmerman and Dr. Carl Barth. They were both in different ways on the inside of that battle for the Bible. They're going to speak from some experience and memory, and it'll be a conversation based, of course, on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February called A Seminary in Crisis. That's Sunday night from 10 to 11, live on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. It's also live on the web. You can listen on the web at kfuo.org from 9 to 11 Sunday night. Dr. Carl Barth and Dr. Paul Zimmerman. Dr. Zimmerman, of course, is the author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February called A Seminary in Crisis. All about that battle for the Bible. When we come back, the Anglican primates met in Tanzania. It's all over. We'll find out what Keith Ackerman Bishop in Quincy, Illinois, has to say.
The message is the mission. You're listening to Issues Etc.
One of the most fascinating stories in American religious life is the story of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in the mid-70s and their battle for the Bible. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February is called A Seminary in Crisis. It's an in-depth study of the history of that battle. You can find A Seminary in Crisis at either of the two Concordia Publishing House bookstores in the St. Louis area, one in the city at 3558 South Jefferson, the other on the campus of Concordia Seminary, where the battle for the Bible took place. Visit either two of the locations and ask for A Seminary in Crisis, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February. That's 3558 South Jefferson in the city or on the campus of Concordia Seminary. Discover the inside and in-depth history of the Lutherans' battle for the Bible with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, A Seminary in Crisis.
Death, it's a battle of two histories.
Answers with Ken Ham, a popular speaker at the Answers in Genesis seminars. Well, Ken, what's death got to do with two histories?
Well, if people believe in billions of years of Earth history, then they must also accept millions of years of death, disease, violence, and suffering leading up to man's existence. You see, those who believe in millions of years think the fossil record, which is full of dead things, was laid down over millions of years. Now, everyone agrees that the fossil record reveals death, diseases like cancer, suffering, and so on. And those who believe in millions of years also believe in a long history of death before man and sin. But the Bible makes it clear that death's an intrusion. It's an enemy that invaded after man appeared on the scene. You see, there was no death of animals or man before Adam sinned. At the end of the sixth day of creation, God pronounced everything very good. And what this means is that if a Christian accepts a history of millions of years of death before man, then they're telling the world that the Bible's history is wrong. No, the Bible's history of death after man sinned is correct, which means you can't logically believe in both the Bible and millions of years.
For our helpful booklet on why we see so much death and suffering in this world, go to our website, answersradio.com. You'll find several free booklets there to help you better understand and share your faith. Look for Ken's booklet on death and suffering when you go to answersradio.com.
Hello, this is Kay Meyer of Family Shield. How do we nurture children so they grow up to be valuable members of our society? What do parents need to do to nurture their children effectively? How do we help our children grow in faith? How do we equip them to trust God in all circumstances? Join us next time as we discuss the spiritual nurture of children.
Family Shield, Saturday mornings at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Historical theology is not just a bunch of names and dates and fact. It's the study of Christ being faithful to his promises.
Dr. Larry Rast of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the importance of historical theology.
Historical theology is the study of theology over the course of time, just like the title says, theology over the course of time. But that can lead some to think that this is a dry, kind of an abstract endeavor. When in fact, what we're talking about with historical theology is the faithful confession ongoing through the church by people that Christ has called, seeing him fulfill the promise that he will never leave the church orphaned or forsaken.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit their website, www.ctsfw.edu.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. 25 minutes left today, this Thursday, the 22nd of February. During this last 25 minutes, we'll be talking with Keith Ackerman, who's Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Quincy, Illinois. And he's also President of Forward in Faith. It's a reform group in the Anglican Communion. I imagine that the position of these reform groups, this is but one of them, the position of these reform groups in the Episcopal Church USA is becoming more and more uncomfortable. I don't think this last week, did much to increase their comfort level in the Episcopal Church USA. The Anglican Primates met in Tanzania, and even in advance of that meeting of the various heads of the provinces in worldwide Anglicanism, even in advance of that meeting, they knew there was going to be trouble. There was a little. I mean, if you call seven of the archbishops saying they will not commune with Catherine Jefferts Schori, the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA trouble, I call it trouble. It's big trouble in the church. We're going to be talking about that meeting and its aftermath. Bishop Keith Ackerman is a regular guest. He's Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Quincy and President of Forward in Faith. Bishop Ackerman, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's very nice to be able to hear all of you again.
Give us your thoughts on what transpired this week in Tanzania.
Well, I have to say that it's extraordinary. It is, on one hand, a roller coaster of emotions. And the reason I say that is because initially so many people said it's rather obvious from what was said in Dramontine, the earlier report, that the primates have absolutely had it with the behavior of the American province, namely the Episcopal Church. But then upon arriving, there were several realities that emerged. First of all, the Archbishop of Canterbury was extremely concerned that the split was absolutely inevitable. And therefore, what he did was he attempted to get all the new primates, 13 of them, and have an orientation session talking about the appropriate type of behavior that one must have. What that meant was 13 new primates were not certain exactly when it was that they could begin the process of stating their concerns. And so the first few days were a little bit placid, but by the end, there was simply no way to be able to contain the primates who know that there is a problem in the Anglican Communion. And so what has emerged is not only a communique, but a covenant concept that has so much teeth in it that a person would have to interpret it in a very unusual way for one to see that it isn't quite pointed and intentional.
Okay, that's your take on the meeting in Tanzania of the primates of the Anglican Communion. This take comes from none other than Presiding Bishop Catherine Jeffords Shorey.
It was a challenging meeting. It began in some graciousness. We heard from three other bishops of the Episcopal Church. The whole meeting did. That was a difficult time for some to hear the diversity and intensity of viewpoints. The primates were clear. A number of them were clear about wanting additional clarity in the responses that the Episcopal Church made at its General Convention last summer.
All right, Bishop Ackerman, two questions. Your response to that, and I'm not quite sure what she meant.
Well, then that would mean that there are two of us, at least, who are likewise having that question. I think that the ambiguous reference to ambiguity is probably what many of the primates are concerned about. To put it a little differently, the question was, did, in fact, the Episcopal Church at the General Convention respond adequately to what was expected? The answer that seemed initially to be put forward was, yes, it had, because it used language that would indicate that it was attempting to do so. However, once the communique was put out, and once there had been ample opportunity for it to be analyzed and discussed, it's crystal clear not only from what the Archbishop of Canterbury said in his final press conference, but also in the communique itself, that there is such ambiguity in the statement that was passed in the resolution at General Convention, that this is it. The Episcopal Church has to be very straightforward in its attempt to be able to clarify its ambiguous language in the resolution. Either you are or you aren't in compliance. And you see, the problem is, what we'll see in the communique is it says, we see your words, but we also see your actions, and there is not a continuity.
Okay. We played some cuts from Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who headed this entire affair up yesterday, I think. And it was a little hard for me to decipher what he was saying. However, he made two things clear. One was that the teaching of the Anglican Communion continues to be that homosexual behavior is incompatible with Scripture.
Yes.
That was altogether clear. But the other thing that he said was the Anglican Communion at this point in time is still a communion. And I assume that to mean the Episcopal Church is still considered to be part of that communion. Am I hearing Rowan Williams correctly on this issue of homosexuality, the issue of gay bishops and the issue of gay marriage in the Episcopal Church?
Yes, and that's exactly what he said. And, of course, the reality is that since there are already bishops who authorize homosexual weddings, marriages, and there are also dioceses where it's being done, If they don't cease and desist, then they have, by their own actions, indicated an unwillingness to remain in the Anglican Communion. In other words, they can't have both. One cannot be in the Anglican Communion and then hold an understanding and participate in a way that's contrary to the belief of that communion.
We talked earlier this week with Father Todd Wetzel, and he mentioned something I hadn't heard on this issue before, and that is that Catherine Jeffords Shorey, the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, has of late been talking about something she's calling the Worldwide Episcopal Communion.
Oh, yeah.
What is this?
Well, this is another attempt to say pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. What happens is the Episcopal Church does, in fact, because of expatriates and because of diplomats in a variety of places, have, quote, an Episcopal presence in 15 different nations. Now, on one hand, of course, unfortunately, that would mean a place like Puerto Rico, which is an American holding, but and it would also mean the U.S. Virgin Islands. It would also mean that in the city of Rome, there is an Episcopal church, an American Episcopal church, and a Church of England church, two Anglican churches close by. So I guess if one wants to claim that makes it a nation, I guess it does. But what lies behind this change in naming, calling it the Episcopal Church USA, and just calling it TEC, the Episcopal Church, is an attempt to be able to say that it in and of itself has a worldwide reality. That would, of course, mean that for some people, the Episcopal Church is attempting to act like a rival communion.
What do you think?
I think it's absurd because I think it's crystal clear that there's a difference between a province of the Anglican Communion and then happening to have some chaplaincies available for people because of the necessity of providing the English language.
Folks, I want to hear from you on the Anglican Primates Meeting and the Episcopal Church USA. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You can also email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'd especially like to hear from our Anglican listeners, issuesetc@kfuo.org or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Bishop Keith Ackerman is our guest. He's Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Quincy and President of Forward in Faith, a reform group in the Anglican Communion. The other thing we talked about with Father Wetzel was the fact that there are already sectors of the Episcopal Church USA, individual dioceses, if I'm not mistaken, who have decided that it's time to exit the Episcopal Church and to bond, to swear their allegiance with the Anglican Communion rather than the Episcopal Church USA. So, what's going on there?
Well, we have several things that we have to look at. Your question is multifaceted. First of all, there are 53 distinct groups that have broken away from the Episcopal Church. And that is called, continuing churches, and they are not in communion with the See of Canterbury, but they're part of the Anglican tradition. Second of all, there are several bodies that are really presence of other provinces in this nation. For example, something called Cana, which is the Nigerian presence, the Anglican Nigerian presence in the United States. Then there's something called the Anglican Mission in America, which is primarily Southeast Asia and Rwanda. Out of desperation, people have sought the protection of primates from around the world, including the Southern Cone, so that there are now a number of threads and a number of strands of Anglicanism in the United States, which wants to be Anglican but does not want to be in the Episcopal Church because either of the leadership of the presiding bishop or because of the General Convention actions.
Real quickly, before we go to the phones, are any of these groups that you mentioned have a stated intention of seeking out formal communion with the See of Canterbury?
Absolutely.
Sally calls from her car. Hi, Sally. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor Todd. My question is for your guest is, so they've made this statement the clarity of how things ought to be, but now are they going to enforce it? Will they, you know, boot out the people that are going against what the church is saying, or what? How does he see this developing? And I'll hang up. Thank you.
It's a great question. It's kind of the endgame question, Bishop Ackerman.
That's a good question that Sally poses, and it's the one that many of us are asking. To put a little differently, the question would be posed of the primates. That would be, you have indicated that failure to comply is in fact tantamount to rejecting your position in the Anglican Communion. So therefore, what are you going to do? So, you know, that's an extraordinarily good question. Of course, here it is. On one hand, I could, for example, if I were the Archbishop of Canterbury, decide who's in and who's out. The way in which the Archbishop of Canterbury does that is he decides which bishops are invited to the meeting that occurs every 10 years called the Lambeth Conference. Every 10 years, all of the bishops of the Anglican Communion are invited to England for the Lambeth Conference. And it's been hinted that perhaps some bishops simply from the United States would not be invited. What the primates are really saying is this: we want to resolve this before the Archbishop of Canterbury begins to send out the invitations to Lambeth Conference. So you have to decide whether you're in or not. So being the one who makes that decision, each province of the Anglican Communion is going to be said to sign on to a covenant agreement, and failure to under the covenant agreement is in effect opting out of the Anglican Communion. And so what the primates have said is that initially that would reduce that particular province to something like observer status, and would also mean that those bishops undoubtedly would not be invited to the Lambeth Conference. Part of our dilemma is that we have not had to deal with this in our 400-year-plus kind of ecclesial existence. That is to say, we trace our roots back to 2,000 years ago, but in terms of an ecclesial structure of 400 years, this was never tested before as long as people acted appropriately and honored each other. All of this need for a structure is a result of people simply not honoring each other and, as I would say, not honoring the Word of God.
Well, here's what Presiding Bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, Catherine Jeffords Shorey, had to say on what message she wants to send to parishioners in the Episcopal Church USA after this meeting of the Anglican primates in Tanzania.
Be of good faith. We're entering Lent, and there's probably not a better time for us to receive this communique from the primates meeting. It will be hard news for a number of members of this church. It will be welcome news for other members of this church. And this is a season to remember who is the focus of our faith, and it is not we ourselves.
Bishop Ackerman, your response?
Well, I was waiting for the end of what she had to say, namely, if it's not ourselves, with which I would agree, that I need to know who the attention is to be on. And I was waiting for her to say Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, the only way to the Father. Because that would be precisely the concern that the primates of the Anglican Communion have. That is to say, what happens is we look at the presenting issues, which in the case that we're dealing with now would be the nature of human sexuality. But there's a far deeper issue, and that is the Lordship of Christ, the uniqueness of Christ, and the fact that he is the only way to the Father. That's really what we're fighting for the soul of the church, is foundational theological and biblical reasoning. And some of the matters that are presented are really a result of a faulty biblical and theological underpinning.
She sounds in that cut, Bishop Ackerman, like she's doing a bit of triangulating. Some people will like the communique, some people won't, but she doesn't say, ostensibly she speaks for the Episcopal Church USA in some sense, she doesn't say whether she's among those who doesn't like it or does like it.
Mm-hmm. Well, inasmuch as when she was Bishop of Nevada, she authorized the blessing of same-sex unions, I have a hunch as to what she might think.
You mentioned before her omission from that comment, and that was, by the way, her entire comment. We didn't
exactly cut
anything out.
Thank you for clarifying, because I knew you didn't, because I read it and I thought I lost a page.
You mentioned there that her failure to say what the explicit focus of the Lenten season in the church's life really is, namely Jesus Christ and his exclusive claims to be the Savior of all sinners. Do we know where Bishop Shorey stands on the exclusive claims of Jesus Christ?
Yes, she says that for Christians, Jesus is the way.
What does that mean?
That would mean that for others, there are other ways to the Father, for other people.
So Jesus' claims are exclusive only for those who think they're exclusive.
That's correct.
So they're not exclusive.
Thank you. You are absolutely correct. And that is exactly what is of concern to the primates. No matter what others might say, it becomes an absolute exercise in futility if we go down the human sexuality path as being what this is all about. That will only take us away from the more underlying reasons of why people around the world are concerned. And we have to also remember something else, and that is the number of Anglicans, let alone Christians, living in Muslim countries today, and that there are a number of Christians today, including Anglicans, who are dying because of their tenacity related to the very things that many people in this country are rejecting, forsaking, and denying.
I have to ask you about one other thing about the Tanzania conference, not something that happened, but something that actually didn't happen. There were seven of the archbishops who did not go to the communion rail, to the Eucharist, and they did this because they could not in good conscience commune alongside Catherine Jefferts Shorey.
Yes.
Is this the first time that something like this has happened when the primates gather for the Eucharist?
No, actually, at Dromontine, there were 13 who, that was a meeting a year ago, 13 who would not go to receive communion because they said that the Episcopal Church had ruptured the communion. But the reason we think only seven this time is because a number of the other ones had retired, and we have 13 new primates in there, and they were so new to it, they were just learning on the fly as to what it means to be a primate. There's something else, though, that needs to be noted, and that is all of those primates came not only as primates of the province, that is, archbishops of their province, but they also came as diocesan bishops, because in the Anglican communion, a primate is also the bishop of a diocese. I mean, the same can be said for the Pope. He may be the patriarch, the pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church, but he's also the Bishop of Rome. The Archbishop of Canterbury may be the primate of the Church, but he's also the Bishop of Canterbury. The presiding bishop in the Episcopal Church has no diocese. It has no authority over a diocese, and therefore has no pastoral relationship to a particular diocese.
And why is that important to note?
It's important to note because it means that the position of the presiding bishop in the Episcopal Church has been put into a kind of CEO model, and means even living where the presiding bishop does on the top floor of a skyscraper in New York City, out of touch to a large extent with the people that a bishop every Sunday has a chance to connect with by doing confirmations and being a different church every Sunday.
What is the current standing of your diocese there in Quincy?
We are a diocese that is in a federation called the Episcopal Church. One of the things that is oftentimes missed is the Episcopal Church is oftentimes assumed to be a denomination or even a, quote, national church, when in fact the Episcopal Church in this country, the Anglican Church in this country, was set up to be a confederation of dioceses in communion with each other. The Diocese of Quincy makes it crystal clear that nothing can be done that would prevent it from being in communion with the rest of the Anglican communion. So we would say that we are, in fact, a diocese within the Anglican communion.
I got to wonder then, we heard from Father Wetzel, he said that there are some who have actually made moves to exit their diocese from the Episcopal Church, and he was of the opinion that Catherine Jefferts Schori would be leading the way to deposing them as bishops.
It would not surprise me at all. In fact, it's quite extraordinary. People have gotten to a point of thinking that there is not fundamentalism in the Episcopal Church because of the casual way that Scripture seems to be regarded. But there is a new fundamentalism. It's canonical fundamentalism. That is, the use of the canon law as being the unerring vehicle. And as a matter of fact, deposition of priests who have left because of conscience sake, that's taking place all around the country. And that's one of the things that the primates were unwilling to budge on. When asked, will you stop making intrusive visits to the United States? They said, well, we'll stop making intrusive visits when you start guaranteeing that the Orthodox and conservative members of the Episcopal Church will not be persecuted.
Bishop Keith Ackerman is president of Forward in Faith North America, a reform group in the Anglican Communion. Their website address is forwardinfaith.com, forwardinfaith.com. He is Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Quincy. Bishop Ackerman, it's always a pleasure. Keep up the good work. Thanks for being our guest.
Well, as always, thank you. And even though we have to respond in what seems to be a terse way, just because these are pointed and good questions, at the heart of it is making Jesus Christ known, worshipped, and adored, and noting that the Word of God is reliable. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go, let me tell you about LCMS World Relief. They are out there on the front lines. They understand one crucial connection, and that is a connection between the love that Christ has shown us sinners and then the service that the sinner, now forgiven and redeemed of Christ, demonstrates to his neighbor wherever he may be. That's why we talk about them having Christ-centered, cross-focused relief efforts around the world. Find out all about it. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll see a picture of Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief right there. You can call 1-888-930-4438 and donate to anything they're doing worldwide. LCMS World Relief. Tomorrow on the program, Dr. Adam Francisco will join us to talk about the Quran. Then Sunday night, the battle for the Bible in the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod with Dr. Paul Zimmerman and Dr. Carl Barth. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.